Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I dug out a thesaurus today, looking for a new way to describe the housing market. We've called it a slump, a downturn, a fall off, a drop off. It's slipping, it's sliding, it's declining, it's in a funk, it's in a rut. But today we'll call it something else I found at the bottom of the synonym pile. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, June 26th. Glad you could join us. The housing market is definitely in a blue period. Today, the country's second largest home builder said this blue period could be longer and bluer than we thought. Lennar Corporation said it lost money last quarter. It's going to lose money this quarter, and the company believes things could get worse before they get better. Economist Christopher Mayer from Columbia University tends to agree.
I think there are a set of markets in the country that are really going to be on a significant slide for quite a while. Markets like Miami, Phoenix, Las Vegas are markets which have just seen a huge amount of new construction, which has exceeded demand.
The government also piled on to the housing market's troubles today. It said new home sales fell 1.6% in May. This wildfire in Lake Tahoe is just awful. It's destroyed 275 homes and buildings so far. Might be the weekend before the fire is contained. Insurance adjusters are already starting to total up the damage. And it's going to be a big bill. But perhaps only a fraction of what's to come. It's so dry across the country, drought conditions might spark a lot more of these big fires. Sam Eaton reports from our sustainability desk.
The Lake Tahoe wildfire is the latest chapter in a record dry spell that covers much of the western and southeastern U.S. The drought is already costing hundreds of millions of dollars in damage. In California, 13 counties have been declared disaster areas due to crop losses. The timber industry has also suffered. But Carol Walker with the Rocky Mountain Insurance Information Association says property damage from wildfires may rival hurricane losses.
We know that from a hurricane perspective, we're facing trillions of dollars in exposure. When it comes to wildfire, we're really in that same boat.
Climate change has ushered in a new era of the mega catastrophe. And before the summer's over, drought may top the list as the most financially damaging. Brian Fuchs is with the National Drought Mitigation Center.
Really, there's not much in the current outlooks for the next several months to show that this is going to subside in any way.
On the contrary, Fuchs says the severe drought in the southeast is spreading northward into the Midwest Corn Belt. And with the ethanol boom causing a record number of farmers this year to skip the more drought-tolerant soybean crop in order to capitalize on high corn prices, a Midwest drought would be devastating.
They're setting themselves up to be a little bit more vulnerable, and that's going to potentially hurt them economically because they don't have that second crop to fall back on.
And he says if that happens, consumers could feel the pinch, paying more for everything from food to insurance. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
In Washington tomorrow, the House takes up a $44 billion appropriations bill. It'll provide money to various parts of the government, the Treasury, the Postal Service, the White House. Tucked away in the White House section is almost $5 million in salaries and expenses for Vice President Cheney. A group of Democrats plans to fight this line item. Marketplace's John Dimsdale gives us the story on it.
This budget spat is the result of Vice President Dick Cheney's claim that his office is exempt from a requirement that executive branch agencies report to the National Archives what documents they're classifying as secret. The vice president argues his office is not an executive branch agency.
It's a particularly hard argument for Vice President Cheney to make, given that he's invested so much in claiming executive power for the vice presidency until now.
Julian Zelizer is a congressional historian at Princeton University.
One of the ways in which Congress reminds executive officials that they are powerful and that they do have influence is by reminding them of the power of the purse.
For its part, the White House agrees the vice president, like the president, is exempt from the National Archives document scrutiny. But the president's spokesman, Tony Snow, today dodged questions on Vice President Cheney's claim that he's not part of the executive branch.
I'll refer that to the vice president's office. What you're really talking about is trying to parse constitutionally. If you go back and, for instance, look at Article 2, there are no specified executive activities for the vice president.
Democrats say they'll try to withhold the vice president's budget as long as he refuses to cooperate with the National Archives. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Wall Street didn't seem to know which way to lean today. The details when we do the numbers. As you know, Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez is taking control of the industries in his country. Today was the deadline for oil companies to hand over their operations. But ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips said, no, we're not going to do that just yet. Joining us from Caracas is Reuters reporter Brian Ellsworth. Thanks for being here, Brian.
Sure.
So what does this mean for the oil companies? Do they still operate there, or are they getting out?
ConocoPhillips has one natural gas project offshore in Venezuela. Exxon has no other projects. It has sold its one small business that it still had. The government has said that this was a friendly agreement and that there is not going to be a lawsuit that follows, though that will, of course, remain to be seen. The government will obviously have to pay Exxon and Conoco for the assets that they gave up.
Because they did make a huge investment into Venezuela. So you're saying that they are going to be compensated equally for what they put in?
They not only made a huge investment, they also took quite a risk, is that they negotiated these projects during the 1990s when oil prices were really at their lowest levels in quite a long time. And they put between $2 and $3 billion each in down payments to make these really large facilities that can turn Venezuela's Orinoco oil, which is almost tar if you look at it, and turn it into this sort of clear substance that's very high quality oil. Part of the dispute over this is that the government wants only to reimburse them basically for what they put into the projects, whereas the companies want to receive the actual value of the projects. It would be a little bit like if, say, you bought GE stock at $10 and it went up to $50 and someone came and offered to buy it back at $10. Well, that's
right.
Only what it cost you. That's what the companies are arguing is, yes, but there's a value here that's not being represented.
Well, also, these companies, these American companies have been running the project here. They have the expertise in this area. What changes now if they're out of there? How will these projects get run?
Well, nobody is suggesting that tomorrow the projects are going to stop running. In fact, the government actually took operational control over the companies on May 1st. But the concern is that Venezuela will not invest sufficiently in these operations, and they will not have the expertise. So over the long run, you could see less oil going out of these projects. This is a concern of the United States, and we've already heard from the U.S. Secretary of Energy saying that the United States is worried this could mean less oil for the United States.
Obviously, the U.S. is watching this very carefully. But what about other Latin American countries? What does this mean for them?
Chavez is already at the forefront of a nationalization crusade all across Latin America. You can see it in Bolivia with Evo Morales. You can see it in Ecuador with Rafael Correa. It's something that is already underway, but to the same extent, it does up the ante, and it gives Chavez a certain cachet to say that he kicked out two gringo companies. At a political level, it does raise the tensions, and it does raise the expectations of a lot of populations across the continent that see Chavez as a natural leader for a Latin American unity movement.
Reuters reporter Brian Ellsworth in Caracas. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. For most school kids, this is the best time of year. I mean, there's no school. But while the kids are out, the adults who run the schools are probably not. School administrators spend their summers looking for teachers. People who teach math and science are always in short supply. And in Texas, so are bilingual teachers. Joy Diaz reports from KUT in Austin.
The Lone Star State has more than 4 million students in grades K through 12. Some 700,000 are English learners. Georgina Gonzalez leads the Texas Department of Bilingual Education. She says more than 90% of students learning English in the state have Spanish as their first language.
Our whole goal is the minute that a student walks into a classroom here in Texas, they must start learning English. So while they're learning their oral language proficiency skills in English, their content area would not be behind. So based on that, the bilingual teachers are needed everywhere.
That need is more evident in the state's fastest-growing areas, such as Dallas, Houston, Austin, and along the U.S.-Mexico border. These places attract a lot of Latin American immigrants. Richard Battier is principal of Blue Bonnet Elementary School, about 25 miles east of Austin. He says more than half his students are Hispanic. Most are English learners. Battier says it's so tough to find bilingual teachers that this year he went south of the border and hired some teachers in Monterrey, Mexico.
We're looking for fluent bilingual teachers. I mean, because our assessments are so rigorous and the Spanish is so formal, we require teachers that have a very good vocabulary in the literature.
Those teachers can help students pass the state's standardized tests, since for the first 2 years, students can be tested in their native languages. Teacher Reina Araceli Perez preps fourth grade English learners at Blue Bonnet Elementary for the state's math test.
What are you going to do tomorrow when you find a problem?
Take your time.
Perez and Battier were connected through Region 4, one of the 20 state-approved organizations that recruit bilingual teachers. Most come from Mexico. Luz María de Los Ángeles Loyola teaches in Mexico City, but is gearing up to move to Texas later this summer. At a Starbucks in the Mexican capital, Loyola, her husband, and their three teenage girls pile out of their SUV. Loyola says she views her move to Texas as a mission.
It's a very worthwhile challenge. I think these children deserve the opportunity to get an education. If they couldn't have it here in their own country, it is really nice that some other countries offering them the chance.
Bilingual teachers have different reasons for coming to the U.S., but they all pay a hefty price out of their own pockets. The cost of immigration procedures, remedial courses, and taking the test for a Texas teaching license comes to around $8,000. Loyola also has to pay for her entire family to move. But salaries are higher in Texas than in Mexico. Teachers start out earning around $40,000 a year, and most districts offer $5,000 stipends to bilingual teachers. That's about three or four times what they made back home. In Austin, I'm Joy Diaz for Marketplace.
Coming up, a chemical that's showing up where it gets a reaction.
If you show it in polar bears or in fish, no one really cares. And if you go for humans, then it becomes real.
But first, let's do the numbers. Those downer housing figures I mentioned earlier and shaky consumer confidence depressed the markets today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 14 points, or a tenth of a percent, to close at 13,337. The NASDAQ lost 2 points, tenth of a percent, to close at 2574. The S&P 500 fell 4 to end the day at 1492. Home builders Lennar and Pulte Homes both fell 3%. Analysts hope they're seeing the end of bad news coming from Bear Stearns hedge funds. Shares edged up about 0.2%. Chemical maker Huntsman saw its stock spike 28% after a Dutch rival bought it for $5.6 billion. Roche made a play for Ventana Medical Systems. Shares of that company jumped 47%. Bond prices dropped. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 5.09%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Open Market Committee meets to discuss interest rates. The Senate Special Aging Committee holds a hearing titled Paid to Prescribe, exploring the relationship between doctors and the drug industry. And it's the anniversary of Bob Keeshan's birthday, better known to those who grew up watching him on morning television as Captain Kangaroo. The late actor was born June 27, 1927. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Scott Jagow, in for Kai Rizdahl. Time to read your letters and emails.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We start with a letter from someone who loves photographs. Glenn Paul from Trenton, New Jersey, pointed out an error in our story about Kodak going digital. It seems we gave Kodak's founder, George Eastman, a little too much credit.
In your article about Kodak, you begin by saying that George Eastman invented rolled film, which is an example of the winners writing history. Actually, a church pastor in Newark, New Jersey invented rolled film, patented it, and set up a company to produce it. He died in an accident, and his successors eventually sold the patent to Eastman for $5 million in 1914, a lot of money at that time.
That pastor, for the record, was Hannibal Goodwin. Another story hit home with Ashley Cunningham of Kansas City, Missouri. We reported on how morale at the Park Service is flagging. They're relying on volunteers a lot more. Ashley manages volunteers. She says you can't put a dollar figure on the work they do.
If the people at the top understood what fell on the backs of volunteers and managers of volunteers and where organizations wouldn't be without these people, maybe they would rethink the value of these highly dedicated, trained, and skilled volunteers and start treating them like Cadillacs instead of Chevys.
Next up, Title IX. Last week, Tess Viglin was filling in as host. She spoke with our commentator Diana Nyad about the anniversary of Title IX. Listener Lee Jones Bamman thought they didn't quite land in the fairway on that one.
I listened to the piece on Title IX and was very disappointed in both Diana Nyad and Tess Viglin. Their conclusion that college football programs should spin off on their own, with the rest of male and female sports equally dividing the remainder of the funds, really dropped the ball. College football is part of colleges, which are educational institutions. They're not profit-making sports ventures.
But Brent Ayer from Frederick, Maryland, thought Tess and Diana hit a hole-in-one.
Diana Nyad's comments on Title IX were right on target. I coach both men's and women's track and field and cross-country at an NCAA Division III level program. I've been thrilled to see the rise in women's opportunities and dismayed to see a corresponding drop in men's track programs, which is almost always associated with the university's big commitment to football.
Finally, a note on the interview we did about fake wedding cakes with Susan Lobsinger. A lot of people wrote in to tell us about a similar tradition in Japan. Susan Yachiye McKean says the idea is not new. She spotted a fake cake at a wedding near Tokyo. As long as the love's real, that's all that matters. If you have any comments, please go to our website, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Contact. If anything catches fire in your house, it's not a good thing. But if it's your TV or your home computer, chances are the fire won't spread too far. Most appliances contain fire retardants. These chemicals can save your home and your life, but they might also pose a health risk. Two of these fire retardants have been phased out over the years. Some states have started putting restrictions on a third. Today we begin a series on this issue. Here's Sasha Aslanian of American Radio Works.
The flame retardant at the center of the environmental debate right now is called DECA. It's a good flame retardant. At a plastics manufacturer in Winona, Minnesota, engineers demonstrate how DECA works. They reach into a ventilated compartment and try to light things on fire using a Bunsen burner. The engineers poke a piece of fire-resistant white plastic, shaped like a popsicle stick, into the flame. Steve Mackey, vice president of the company RTP, points out how the stick stops burning as soon as the torch is pulled away.
But you saw again how quickly, when you remove that flame, within a matter of what was probably a second or so, that fire went out.
That stick was treated with DECA. Next, the engineers try a plastic stick with no flame retardant. The bar of plastic curls like melted wax.
The whole bar is engulfed in flame right now. There's dripping particles of the polypropylene going down, igniting whatever source is below. Pretty much this bar is going to burn all the way up. There won't be anything left.
Not what you'd like to have happen at your house. But the rap on DECA is that it's spreading in the environment and it's toxic. DECA is showing up in pretty much everyone's body. At a health clinic in Minneapolis, 30-year-old Sarah Grahowski participates in a blood test sponsored by an environmental group. She's brought along her baby boy, Lucas.
Well, so far they drew 5 vials of blood, and then we had to do a 24-hour urine sample.
Flame retardant chemicals accumulate in human body fat. For a nursing mom like Grahowski, the fat becomes breast milk, Lucas's food.
He's pretty much still exclusively nursing, and I think that alone is what makes me the most anxious. And so if it contains, you know, some of these chemicals that I've been exposed to, you know, I think that would make me the most irate.
When industrial chemicals show up in breast milk, it gets people's attention. The flame retardant problem first came to light about 10 years ago when a Swedish scientist, O.K. Bergman, found the chemicals in human milk.
If you show it in polar bears or in fish, no one really cares. And if you go for humans, then it becomes real. And the mother's milk was really what was the ignition of the whole thing.
In 1998, American scientists started checking for flame retardants. They found levels 10 to 100 times higher than in Europe. Worse, the chemicals resemble some well-known environmental bad guys, PCBs, banned in the 1970s. Tom McDonald is a former toxicologist with California's Environmental Protection Agency who studied the chemicals.
It became very clear when early on when we looked at the structure and saw that these act in many similar ways to the PCBs, causing harm to the developing brain in terms of behavior and memory and offspring, as well as alterations to the reproductive organs.
In 2003, California became the first American state to follow the European Union, banning 2 common flame retardants. 9 other states passed similar laws. The American manufacturer stopped making the banned chemicals. The restrictions didn't touch DECA, but this year, 9 states considered bans on DECA, and 2, Maine and Washington, passed restrictions. The EPA lists it as a possible carcinogen, and in animal studies, it's been shown to harm brain development in rats and mice. It can take decades for science to reach a conclusion, but the marketplace isn't waiting. Mark Rossi of Clean Production Action, a nonprofit that promotes safer chemicals, says the healthcare sector in particular has been demanding alternatives to DECA.
They buy lots of computers, they buy TVs to put in patient rooms. And the healthcare sector has actually been a real leader in looking at the chemicals in the products that they're buying and telling their suppliers, we don't want these chemicals.
Flame retardant manufacturers are fighting back with TV ads and lobbying campaigns. Spokesman John Kite says DECA has been exhaustively studied and has a very good track record. Kite says electronics makers are bowing to pressure from environmentalists.
It's an effective tactic, but it's a wholly unfair tactic because it doesn't rely on
science and analysis and research and fact. It relies on emotion.
States will have to put those emotions aside in order to measure the danger they see, fires, against a danger they can't see, how flame retardants affect the developing brain. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Sasha Aslanian for Marketplace and American Radio Works.
Sasha's report on fire retardants continues tomorrow on this program and the Marketplace Morning Report.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A new magazine debuted today. It's the first one devoted entirely to helping people get their homes in order. Why not? Home organizing is about a $7 billion business. This magazine simply called Organize. As soon as I heard about this, only one person came to mind. Hi, Mom.
Hi, Scott.
How are you?
I'm just fine. How are you?
Good. My whole life, I've heard the same phrase over and over again. I'm just trying to get organized. Exactly what does that mean?
It's a 37-year-old clean out. And I've been working on it steadily. And I'm actually doing better. You know that I'm doing better because we have a car in the garage now. And you know there wasn't one before.
Right, because of all the boxes.
We've had 3 moves, and a lot of those boxes never got opened.
Well, that's because you don't throw anything away. Now, you know that.
That's right. I have lived with the premise that you don't throw anything away. I get that from Grandma and from my whole family. You know, somebody might be able to use it. Someone else's trash is someone else's treasure.
So if I said, Mom, can you go find my baseball cards? Would you be able to find them?
Actually, I know where they are.
You do? Where are they?
Your sister has them. She's keeping them in safeguard for you.
Today, they launched an entire magazine devoted to being organized. Is that something you would take time to read?
I think I need a subscription to it. I think a lot of people struggle with just how do I do this? And it's not only how you do it, it's getting the motivation to continue to do it and do it so that you get a closure on it where you can say, I have truly done it and got rid of it.
All right, Sharon Jagel, professional organizer. Thanks, Mom.
You're welcome. And the next time you come home, there's going to be less.
We'll see. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 14 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ slipped 2 points, also 0.1%. The S&P 500 dipped down 4 points, or 0.3. Thanks to Miguel Macias, Doug Krisner, and Renita Jablonski on our morning crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time on the program, firefighters risk their lives on the job battling flames and harmful chemicals. I'm Scott Jagel. Please join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.